Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics, mainly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and he's back, the Formula One correspondent of Mega City Book Club. He also works for some newspaper called The Guardian as well, apparently. He's returning for what I've put down as his third visit, but actually enclosed in Film Club. This is fourth visit. Giles Richards, welcome back.
Hi, Eamon. Pleasure to be here, and as always. And yes, it is my fourth visit.
I'm not sure
at what point one qualifies for the an extra badge or something.
You get a T-shirt, a free T-shirt for your next one.
Right. Okay. Well, let's sort that out so I can add it to my beer mat. That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Very much looking forward to that.
Yeah. Your namesake Giles Wright has suggested the T-shirt, so now we have a 5-star club. For people who get to a fifth appearance. So anyway, that'll be next time.
Fantastic.
Now, you suggested a book that came out fairly recently, a collection that came out fairly recently for a return to the book club. And this worked out for me because I was able to fit it in quickly and it meant we could get back to 2000 AD. Tell us about the book you've chosen to come on this time.
I've chosen the new Stainless Steel Rat Colour Omnibus, which is not the first time the Stainless Steel Rat has been collected, but the first time it's been coloured and collected into an omnibus. And this, I believe this came out last year.
Yes, end of 2024.
Yeah, end of 2024. First time it's been coloured, I saw it and I thought, look at that. I mean, this is an endlessly joyous collection. And it just made me really want to talk about it. I feel for anybody who's not read the Stainless Steel Rat, and by that I mean the comic or the book, all the books actually, which are fantastic as well. But if you've not read this, then this would be an absolute treat for anyone to pick up.
So treats to come. Let's just say we have done the Stainless Steel Rat before on the book club, all the way back in episode 58. Jake Eberlin, if you're listening, Jake, we covered it then, but we're doing the coloured omnibus that has come out recently. Now, obviously, created by Harry Harrison, but adapted for 2000 AD by Kelvin Gosnell, art by Carlos Esquerra, colours Janet Landau, lettered Jack Potter and Pete Knight, the original editor, obviously, Steve McManus at the time. First appeared in 2000 AD, Prog 140. It had three stories, and the three stories are all collected here, which sort of ran between 79 and 85. I think the colour version comes from the Eagle Comics 1-6 rodent editions, as they were called.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the colouring a bit later on. So, obviously, we are revisiting the Stainless Steel Rat. Why did you want to go back to this story? Was it this particular collection?
Well, it was the collection that made me want to talk about it. But it's a strip I've loved, long loved. I mean, I first read this. The first one I read, there's three stories here. There's the Stainless Steel Rat, which is your introduction. The Stainless Steel Rat Saves the World, and the Stainless Steel Rat for President. And I first came. The first two ran just before I came to 2000 AD, but the third one, I read The Stainless Steel Rat for President I would have been about 13 or 14, I think, at the time, and I adored it then. I read the first two in later years and absolutely loved those. And I've seen an omnibus of it since, but going back to this, There's a peculiar thing about this. There's two reasons I wanted to do it. One, obviously, there's very much a sense of going back to the feeling you get when you first read it, which is always fantastic. I mean, you know, so there's the fact that it's been coloured. I've never seen it coloured before, and I'll say in advance, I think it's been coloured brilliantly. And then there's also the fact that I genuinely think this is an object lesson in brilliant storytelling. It's a brilliant adaptation of a novel. It's a combination of of writing, wit, storytelling with art, with an artistic style that is perfectly fitted to this story, perfectly fitted. And again, with Carlos, which we'll get into, but it comes together, I think, in a package that is extraordinary, and from which I will come to again later, from which I think many people could still learn from today. You know, and it stood the test of time enormously well, and I defy anyone of any age, in fact, but of particularly, I think, kids. I mean, I think this was aimed at, when it was written, this was aimed at 2080s audience at the time, which, of course, back then was genuinely 12-year-old kids, 12, 13-year-old, 14-year-old kids. And I would defy a 12-year-old kid of today not to love this as much as a 54-year-old man who watches cars go round in circles for a living.
So are you able to fill us in on a little bit of the history of Harry Harrison's creation, the novels, and who is the Stainless Steel Rat?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Harry Harrison was an American novelist, prolific American novelist. He wrote hundreds of books and short stories, etc. He's possibly best known for his novella Make Room, Make Room, which was adapted into the film Soylent Green, which is one of those 1970s sci-fi films which I remember watching, which is, you know, probably best known for its literally the last 2 or 3 minutes of the film than it is what was an actually average movie. But he wrote 12 novels in the Stainless Steel Rat series. The first one was in 1961, amongst a whole host of other. He did a lot of series books. He did a great series of books called Bill the Galactic Hero, for example, which also ran for a long time. So he did 12 of these, and they were dearly loved. Everyone loved Stainless Steel Rat. Again, I read them. I still have some of them. I haven't read them recently. I didn't want to reread them while reading this, but they stand the test of time as well. They're just as sort of vibrant and witty now as they were then. They you know, really, really work really well. But they were novels, so they had to be adapted for the comic format, which Harry, who had done comics himself in the past. I think he wrote and illustrated them, I think I'm right in saying. But they had to be adapted, you know, from that, and that was where Kelvin Gosnell came in, and Kelvin Gosnell did an absolutely bang-up job on this. You know, again, I think this is one of the best adaptations I've read of any novelization. So that was, Harry Harrison did, he passed away in 2012. But he was enormously approving of this. He worked very closely with Gosnell. The pair became friends as they worked on it. So there was, I think the fact it was so collaborative was definitely a factor in why this is so successful. It wasn't just a case of 2000 AD saying buying the rights to the book and saying, right, off we go. They did it together. There was very much a to and fro around it, and I think that really shows in how well it's been done.
Before we get to the sort of dramatis personae of the characters in this, can I just mention that story about Harry Harrison having a letter printed in 2000 AD when he pointed out that in the first episode they put the panel explaining who the Stainless Steel Rat was at the end rather than at the start. And I understand he did get the £3 letter prize for that.
Apparently, all true. Yes, he did. He did. It was actually one of the great things about 2000 in those days was that the letters page was very, very vibrant. And everyone, you know, people used to write in. And, of course, you'd get a £3 prize if you did your drawing of Tharg or of a character. I remember, well, the trend in those days was to draw Tharg crossed with something.
Yes.
So it would be Tharg the Elephant or Tharg the Dread or whatever, and it would be an unholy mixture of the two, and you'd win your £3. But yeah, they put the panel in the wrong place. And Harry Harrison being quite, I mean, I don't know an enormous amount about him, but he was clearly a good sport because he clearly took this project to heart and joined in with it and made, and you know, being a good sport, did the decent thing, and didn't complain about it or anything, but just wrote in pointing out the error, and Tharg quite rightly said, congratulations on spotting no doubt what Tharg referred to as a deliberate mistake, because he would never make an error. Congratulations on spotting it. Here's your £3, which was a princely sum in those days as well. For the younger listeners, you know, that'd be about 40 quid now. So yeah, I mean, that's a great story, and I think lovely example of how Harry looked at this working with 2000 AD.
I will consult my friend Stephen Watson and find out which prog that letter was in, and post a picture of it next week when this episode comes out. Okay, so tell us, the stainless steel rat. Remind us, who are the main characters in these three stories?
Right. Well, obviously. We'll start with the stainless steel rat. That's Slippery Jim DeGriz. He's the lead character. It's a fantastic setup, this. I mean, this is one of the reasons it works so well. It's a fantastic setup. It effectively exists in a post-scarcity galaxy where there is effectively no crime, almost no crime. And everyone sort of lives quite happily. But the only crime that does exist is it tends to be by people who want to commit crime because they enjoy it. And Slippery Jim is one of those. He's not necessarily avaricious. He's certainly not evil. He has an extremely strong moral code, but he just gets a big buzz out of nicking stuff. And when I say nicking stuff, I mean things like robbing banks. He's a proper criminal. And he really enjoys it, but he does it with absolute flair and abandon and joie de vivre. You want to be Slippery Jim, you really do, in this novel. And he is the stainless steel rat because he reiterates on several occasions, you know, in this future world, in the old world, rats used to slip through the cracks and go places other people couldn't go. And in this future world, the only rat that could exist would be a stainless steel rat. And that's him. So he is out doing his thing, which is sort of joyously robbing with great verve, and finds himself going up against the galactic police, who are called the Space Corps. And we meet them in the first series, which is where we also meet Jim's wife to be, who is called Angelina. Again, Jim. I mean, I should point out, obviously, and I guess we'll come to this, is Jim. The way Carlos draws Jim is as James Coburn, identically. And again, I don't know if you could do that now. I'm not sure whether that would bring, I don't know, Hollywood lawyers on you or something, or I don't know, but you could in those days, and it was a perfect choice, just as it was with Major Easy. Angelina, he meets his wife to be Angelina in this first one, who, as we discover, again beautifully drawn, is a psychotic criminal who takes great pleasure in being a criminal and murdering in particular. So it with Jim's very, very strong moral code that he insists that he doesn't want to kill people, and he feels strongly that there's a sense of right and wrong to his criminal activity, which again makes him a great character. But Angelina is a proper scary psychotic killer, and the two become embroiled in this adventure in the very first episode. And by the end, he delivers Angelina to the Space Corps, and they work on her they give her psychotherapy, etc., and manage to cure her psychotic tendencies. And by the start of the second series, Saves the World, he and Angelina are married, which is fantastic. I should also point out, Angelina to me, and I don't know what you think about this, Eamon, Angelina to me looks like Servalan from Blake 7.
Yes.
Right.
On Blokes of a Certain Age.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yeah, for our younger viewers, just ignore this.
Jacqueline Pierce,
Jacqueline Pierce. And I double-checked this, and Blake 7 came out before the first of this. So I'm not ruling out that Carlos might have been over in the UK and seen Blake 7 and thought, well, that's, you know, taken that as a bit of inspiration. He's not afraid of using inspiration.
It's good.
You can see all over the place. So yeah, there's definitely, she's very cute. I'll be honest, he does a very sexy. So that, you know, she's great. And then, I mean, then really the only other two sort of major characters that we come across are there, by the third story, Jim and Angelina have had two children, James and Bolivar, and they've grown up a bit and they join them on their adventures, which makes it even more fun because suddenly it's a family affair and Slippery Jim's doing one thing, Angelina's doing another, and the kids are desperately trying to join in, flying helicopters, blowing things up. I mean, it's like by then it's a family romp. It's absolutely fantastic. So I mean, that's basically there are supporting baddies that they come up against, but you know, that's about the size of it in terms of the major characters.
Okay. Well, I mean, it is rollicking good fun. I've put in the notes space heist, although the second and third story are more sort of, as you say, space adventures. He's saving the world or saving another world and coming up against some very memorable baddies, a couple of whom we might get to in a moment. Let's do the other thing that we wanted to do, which was drool about Carlos's art. And I'm just going to refer quickly, as you've mentioned, James Coburn, that my friend Conrad from Space Spinner, who, of course, you've been on Film Club with Conrad, said memorably that the best James Coburn movie is The Stainless Steel Rat by Carlos Ascari.
I think he might be right.
Right.
This is James Coburn's greatest role. You know.
So tell us a little bit about Carlos's wonderful work on these three stories of The Stainless Steel Rat.
Well, this, again, I said at the start, I think this is it's an object lesson in storytelling and art coming together. And I think this is, I mean, Carlos had such a long career and it was so good. But this is peak Carlos, you know, which is doing him a disservice because I think he was at peak Carlos for an enormously long time.
Yes, he was.
But this is, you know, he'd completely hit his stride now, and maybe he never lost that stride. You know, I don't know. I mean, I genuinely think that maybe in several decades' time or with time to come, people will look back at Carlos's art as a body of work, and it will be recognised as genuinely huge cultural significance because it is so good and there was such a longevity to it and he covered so many different subject matter. I think, you know, he's not been not long with us now, but I think time will give people a perspective on that will put Carlos on an absolute pedestal. But so yeah, I mean, here he's doing everything brilliantly. He's as you pointed out, he's come to this having done war stories in battle, and that has worked fantastically well because this is an action strip effectively. It's classic golden age 2000 AD. There's a bit of setup, and then Jim gets into action. There's a lot of gunplay in it. There's a lot of spaceships. There's gunships. There's tanks. Everything that, you know, I mean, think of the Apocalypse War. It's all like that, but without war and without an actual war, although it comes pretty close in a couple of times. And Carlos is going. He's going everywhere with this. He's drawing everything. There's fist fights. There's Western style gunplay. You name it, he's doing it, and he's doing it really, really. He's doing it with great brevity as well, because he's fitting it into these weekly progs. So he's still telling that story, but telling it with such pace. I mean, you do have to, while reading this, the temptation is you're just reading and reading because the story is paced as such that it just makes you want to read, and you do have to stop and say, I need to go back and look at this properly because I'm being forced to move on really quickly because it's so well done. And his art is making you like, what's the next panel? What's the next panel? What's the next panel? So there is fantastic thing. There's all sorts of lovely Carlos art in this. There's double page spreads. There are certain sections. Certain bits where I can't help but feel he's having fun. He's literally having fun. So there's a moment early on when he says, when Jim instructs a robot to shoot two holes in a wall, and the robot says, "What sort of holes?" "Just holes we can go through," says Jim. And then in the next panel, what you see the holes the robot has shot in the wall are exactly the shape of a robot and a human. Now, I don't know if that is in the script. I sort of doubt it was. It probably just said shoot two holes in the wall. But the way Carlos has drawn it, which is fantastic, is literally human shaped and robot shaped, so that him and Jim can walk through it, which is just a fantastic touch. And there's another moment later on when again Jim's being chased by a dozen police cars, all of whom end up at the same junction at the same time and end up piling on top of each other in a big pile, which feels to me like that iconic scene in The Blues Brothers, which I don't doubt Carlos had also seen. So there's lots of lovely little touches like that. There's the thing that he does that he often uses in his work, like where he big buildings have a similarity to the Gaudi Cathedral in Barcelona, the Sagrada Familia, which has popped up in his art many times before. And I think there's a deliberate that the bad guy in President is President Zappellotti, who I think bears a deliberate resemblance to General Franco.
Who
Carlos didn't approve of, and I think he's having a lot of fun making Zappellotti a sort of loathsome slug, and having Jim point out how loathsome he is to him on a regular basis. So there's lots of those lovely touches, but really I think it's what's absolutely the triumph for Carlos here is how well he's telling the story. You know, how brilliantly he's able to move the story on, pull off the action so well, such that you're gripped by it from start to finish. I mean, it's really, really, as I said, it's Pete Carlos. If only there was any bits that weren't Pete Carlos in his career, but this, if you haven't read it, as I said earlier, I think you're in for an absolute treat in seeing how well he's done this.
The Spanish Jack Kirby in British comics. You know, there is so much going on each page, so much action. It rarely goes more than a page or two before there's a fight scene or something like that. He does, and it's lovely to see some of the sort of bits and pieces that, you know, we're familiar with from Carlos. Like you say, James Coburn. I noticed that in the Stainless Steel Wrap for President, they drive a car, and it's very similar to the, I'm sure you as an automotive appreciator would say, Major Easy's long bonneted Bentley.
It's clearly Major Easy's car.
Yes. Yeah.
I made a note of that at the time. I said, well, he clearly loves you. I mean, it's got that huge front engine, and all he's done is put a couple of big balloon wheels on the back to make it look more sci-fi. But yeah, I mean, little touches like that. I love that. Anyone who likes Carlos is going to love that sort of thing.
And I noted last time with Jake, in fact, I chose this as my grail page, I think last time, was that in the middle story, Stainless Steel Rat Saves the World, there's a point where somebody is explaining what the villain he has done to the world. And there's a scene which is sort of like a flashback scene on a raft of people tearing at each other and fighting, which is based on a famous painting, The Raft of the Medusa by Jericho. And I was astonished, you know, even there, that Carlos was putting this stuff in a weekly British comic for kids that was designed to be thrown away.
I mean, fantastic, isn't it? I mean, imagine, yes. I mean, I don't, again, as you say, kids 12, 13-year-old wouldn't know who General Franco was, I doubt, or the Sagrada Familia, but Carlos was just drawing on everything. And that's part of his genius, I think. You know that, and he wasn't ashamed, he wasn't embarrassed about doing that either, to show his influences, etc. You know, so he's also it was again through his career, the characterizations here are so good. Like, you know, I know he's using James Coburn, but he gives Jim such expression. I mean many might think James Coburn isn't a great example because he was quite stony faced as an actor. But Carlos gives him such a wonderful range of expressions and sense of motion to him and empathy with him that I mean, in that way, I guess he's not really, because Coburn was always often typecast as a heavy, whereas Jim is really not a heavy at all. He's all brains, but with an ability to wield a rather mean gun when it requires. So yeah, he's hitting a lot of bases there, I think. You know, also with I think what's notable is in a book like this where there is so much wit. There's so much wit that you do require a light touch to pull off as well. There's a lot of action, but there is a constant stream of brilliant humor in this. And there's, I mean, and Carlos again, I think is pretty much perfect for doing that. There's a great moment when Jim interrupts some sort of banquet or something, and in the process of doing, well, I think he lands his spaceship near it, and in the process of doing it, a woman gets her face shoved into a trifle, and Carlos, she's just got this perfect scene of the woman sort of pulling her face out, half covered in trifle, and he pulls it off perfectly, and it's again the sort of thing you might just miss slightly if you were whizzing through it, but the, again, rereading just rewards you all the time and time again.
You know, you've mentioned her already. I'll say that Slippery Jim DeGriz is the best there is of what he does, except for his lovely wife Angelina, who's always better at it than he is. And, you know, several times throughout these stories demonstrate that she's always got the slight upper hand on him. But whatever she does it in a rather sort of wonderful Carlos sexy fashion, doesn't she, with a certain sort of hip tilt or whatever.
She does. I mean, she's the sort of, they cured her sort of her desire to kill, but she remains the sort of the hard edge of the DeGriz duo. And so she's always more keen to deal with something with a weapon and pretty smartish, and Jim has to sort of, they have a wonderful wordplay between them when Jim's saying, "Oh, you know, no, my darling, let's not kill on this occasion," the sort of thing, and she's going, "You're such a spoil sport, Jim," etc. It's that sort of, it's like a 1970s British sitcom, but with murderous robbers having the interactions instead, and he draws Angelina in that way. He draws, like, she's in the de rigueur 1970s sort of one piece catsuit type space outfit, which are generally skin tight with etc. And she looks great. But she's also a very strong female character too. You know, she as I said, she's Jim gets in trouble, Angelina gets him out of it all the time, repeatedly, and she generally does it by getting him out of it with you know, quite often with violence that's really entertaining. There's a fantastic scene where one of the a man interrupts Jim and says, I don't want to talk to the woman, I want to talk to the man, and Jim just steps back and says, "Oh dear, I wish you hadn't said that." And then clearly off camera, you hear this man being administered a massive beating by Angelina. And then the next time you see her, she's sort of walking on, shaking the dust off her hands. And then you see this poor guard's feet on the floor, all that sort of thing. So you know, I mean, that's great stuff. She's a great character. She's a really great character. I don't think I said, but I mean, you know, so the first story, just to sum them up. The first story is Jim is caught and recruited by the Space Corps into becoming one of their agents, which he does reluctantly, and he sees it as a means to an end, so he can work on their behalf and also keep going about surreptitious crime. And that's when he meets Angelina. The second book is Stainless Steel Rat Saves the World, where working for the Space Corps, he discovers a fiendish plot by a villain called, who is known only as Him, to change history by removing people from the past. And we get a huge to and fro time travel episode, which is fantastic. And Angelina, of course, rolls into that. Jim is sent back in time to thwart Him's actions, which leads to some brilliant time travel type shenanigans. So he ends up on Earth in the 1850s or whatever, when Napoleon's conquered England using tanks and aeroplanes and all that sort of thing, which does lead to one of my favorite moments, which again shows the level of wit in this, is that Jim encounters a French soldier. He lures the French soldier away by dropping a load of gold coins in front of him, and the French soldier spots them and goes, "Ho ho ho, ho ho ho, encore, encore!" And then when Jim confronts him, he goes, "Zut alors!" Now, I'm sorry, but the only people who ever said "Zut alors" in was people who studied French in the 1970s. I've never heard a French person say "zut alors" ever, but it is hilarious. It is absolutely hilarious. And another moment when, in the same scenario, he's having another French soldier has confronted him, and he says "arrête," which means stop. And Jim is quite distressed at the time because he's just been blown up, and he just turns to him and says, "I've just been blown up and almost drowned." Punches the French soldier on the face and says, "Arrête that, pal." Which, I guess, just Carlos is brilliant. The writing's brilliant. That's absolutely fantastic. So yeah, he time travels around and eventually thwarts Him by a method which I'm sure Conrad Leyden, our friend Conrad Leyden, would refer to as Bill and Tedding his way out of the end of it. What if we sent this back in time to be here when we were here when we need it? And that's what they do. And it feels like it ends a bit abruptly, but it's a lovely bit of Bill and Tedding, and I love Bill and Ted. Who doesn't love Bill and Ted? So
exactly.
Yeah, there's Him, and then as I said, the final one, he faces down in Stainless Steel Rat for President, he faces down the evil President Zappalotti, who is a dictator based on General Franco, and runs for president. James and Bolivar come along to help. He gets up to all sorts of electioneering scams. I think that's the best of the three for me. Carlos's art is at an absolute top end on that one. There's all sorts of brilliant large scale action scenes, war type scenes where they've got tanks and burrowing moles and helicopter battles, etc. You know, it's all going on in that one, and there's lots of that sort of I was going to say dark humor, but it's not really dark humor. It's just humor. It's just funny. You know, it's a sort of almost a pastiche in its own way of serious political films, you know, but turned up to 100.
So obviously it's great creations by Harry Harrison, a great adaptation by Kelvin Gosnell, just superlative Carlos Escara storytelling throughout, just all wonderful. And then it's in colour, which I think, as I say, was coloured in 1986 for the Eagle Comics reprints by Janet Landau, who I don't know if she was related to Nick Landau, who, of course, was running Eagle Comics. Mm. But what do you make of the colouring of this? Because it is this is pre-digital proper colouring in a way, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure what to expect. when I opened this. But I have to say, within just reading within two or three pages, I really liked it. And it was and because this isn't, this, as you well know, there's no guarantee they're going to get this right, or that it would improve it, or that it would, or in some cases make it worse. But Janet Landau has done an absolute bang up job on this. The colouring is great. It really works. I mean, to her credit, only a few pages in, I wasn't noticing that it was coloured, in the sense that I wasn't feeling like, oh, I preferred this when it was in black and white at all. It felt completely normal to me. It fitted. It wasn't none of it jars. It just really works with Carlos's art. I think as you've mentioned, this looks like Carlos could have done it himself.
Yeah,
you know, old school hand colouring. It really looks lovely. It looks like, I think, if they'd had the money back in the early 1980s, this is what I imagine it would have looked like, you know, and it wasn't printed on bog paper. But, you know, this is as good as it would have been if they could have afforded to do that then. I mean, obviously, I think they probably managed a few color spreads back in those days. I can't remember without going back to the progs. But I don't think they would have done it any better back then, and as it is, I mean, again, if this brings it to a new audience, then that, I can only applaud that, because, you know, I understand there are issues around kids wanting to read things in colour, and this is no detriment to that whatsoever, and I don't feel, as might be the case with other ones, that I would think, oh, I really wish I'd prefer to read it in black and white in its original. Whereas this, I would go, no, if I was recommending this, I'd say read the color one. Cause everything is there and it's been beautifully painted. I mean, really, a really, really great job that I think is great. And, you know, Jim looks fantastic. Angelina looks fantastic. The space scenes, and there's, you know, there are big scenes in this. They're only improved by this colouring.
It's just wonderful. Very beautifully done back in 86. And fantastic that they're able to put it out now in this colour omnibus. Last time you were on, of course, we were talking about V for Vendetta being in colour and how we wanted it in black and white. Now, Rebellion, I know, as you say, there's a market for things in colour that might not be there for all black and white stuff. So I know they've done the Apocalypse War, they've done Halo Jones in colour. Is there anything, seeing how well this one was done, is there anything else you can think of from 2000 AD's library in black and white that you would like to see a colour version of?
Well, it was after reading this, I had to think about that, in fact. I had a longer thing, and you might be able to correct me if I'm wrong, but what my immediate thought of was the two I would like to see was Meltdown Man.
Ooh, right.
Which I don't think exists in colour. If it does, then I've completely missed it. And similarly, Ace Trucking.
Right.
I think Meltdown Man, done well, could look, because Belardinelli's art in that is extraordinary. Done well, I think it could be fantastic, because it's so fantastical. The setting is so exotic. I don't know. I think it'd be a tough job because the way he draws and the way he, you know, there's often so much detail in his work. But I felt that was one of those. I just felt the story lent itself to colour. When's he going to melt down, etc. but I thought that, and Ace Trucking's the other one, which it just feels like a story. I'd love to see what colour GBH, how they'd colour GBH, or Ace as well, you know. And again, that has all those elements of fantastic space journeys and exotic locations, all that sort of thing, that I just think might work really well. The issue there is how well it could be done, and that's the big, I mean, it's been done here, it's been done for the Rat brilliantly. I don't know, you know, but they're two I'd love to see. I mean, I also thought I'd probably like a go on Harry 20 in colour, which I suspect would be easier to colour. But doesn't have quite, because that's quite a sort of singular location. It would have less scope for the exciting colouring, so less so on that. But have you got any that you'd want to see?
I suppose, I mean, going back to what you and I talked about before, there's some Brian Bolland stuff that might be quite interesting to see in colour. Dread versus Death is a tricky one because the black and white is just so beautiful as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
But Meltdown Man's a fascinating one. You know, it's nice and self-contained. You could get it all in one volume. That's an interesting one. Yeah.
I think that would be fun. I mean, I think you just mentioned, I'm still waiting for them to do the full black and white version of V for Vendetta, which has to be one of comic publishing's greatest fails ever, that still does not exist. it feels like it's almost willfully perverse for that not to exist now, given also that it would be, it's an absolute no-brainer in that, I don't know, if you could just do a limited edition, it would sell out. You know, just it makes no sense to me, and it's you know, It feels like it's a slight poke in my ribs every now and then that doesn't exist.
They're
not going to listen to us, I'm afraid.
Okay, we're going to play the Grail page in a moment, so I'm going to ask you about some Grails in colour. Before I do that, I'll just say that the book has got at the back the stainless steel rack covers. It's got throughout the book, it's got the Eagle covers, and then at the back there's some of the 2000 AD colours. Covers are printed as well, but of course we both noted before we started recording there's something that's not in the book, which was rather a shame.
I mean, it was interesting that we both noticed this independently without even talking about it, is that there's no introduction in this book, which I think of what is a fantastic package is talking about comic fails, is a big failure on this, on behalf of the Rebellion, because if any book cried out for an introduction, it was this one. I mean, in it, to a great extent, you know, a Dread volume or whatever needs very little to be said about it, frankly. But this being a collaboration between a very well-known and prolific science fiction writer and a comic publisher in the early 80s, late 70s and early 80s. That's a story that has to be told. It has to be put in context, you know, and I find it very odd that it's lacking, especially given that in the Christmas edition of the magazine, they did a two-page text article introducing an episode of Stainless Steel Rat, and it includes enormous amounts of information from Kelvin Gosnell and about Harry Harrison and about how the pair work so closely together, and it was exactly what I would have liked to have read as an introduction to this. And I think if anyone was coming at it cold, having it put in context, you know, that this was the late 70s, early 80s, this was where 2000 AD was at the time. This, I think, it was quite a big deal, you know. I mean, to not only secure the rights for this, but to have it done in collaboration with Harry Harrison. This was a real coup, and it happened. I'm not altogether sure if it's happened again since, or certainly nothing on this scale. I don't think has happened since, and I don't think I've seen in a British comic. I don't think I've seen a novelization. A comic adaptation of a novel as successful as this ever, and that in its own way is worth talking about. You know, they should be applauded for doing that. But I want to hear about how that happened. I want to hear about it, and it did, and it clearly happened in a very positive and productive way. So a couple of pages of that would have gone down a treat. I mean, again, maybe they're thinking that there'll be a kid audience and kids don't care, but you know, even anyone reading it, I think would be interested in that, and again, pointing people at Harry Harrison's novels would be nice, because they're not going to be disappointed. They're another at least another 9 they could go and read after these 3. So, and they're all great, you know. So, yeah, I can't help but feel that is a little letdown, you know. In a way, I don't know if it's a space issue. In a way, I'd almost happily give up a couple of covers to have a couple of pages of introduction.
So you pointed out to me the Christmas issue of the magazine, this 2024 Christmas, the 2-page Year of the Rat by Carl Stock, which features, as you said, contributions in there from Kelvin Gosnell, from Robin Smith, from Michael Carroll. Why isn't that in there?
But yeah. Well, all I can say is to listeners, you know, if you're getting this to read, if you get the omnibus to read, just go and read that article beforehand, because that's effectively your perfect introduction. It is great. Yeah. Well, I don't know why that's not there.
Okay. Well, let's not talk about stuff then that's not in there. Let's talk about stuff that is in here in color. Now, we're playing the Grail page game. There are rules, unfortunately, and I had to limit you that you couldn't pick the pages that Jake and I had picked in episode 58, which I know spoiled one of your choices. What did you end up with,
Giles? Well, I wanted that fantastic double page spread that Jake had picked.
Which was the cover to Prog 393, the wraparound movie poster style
for President, yes.
Stainless steel wrap for President,
it's absolutely glorious. It's got Jim and Angelina, it's got President Zappellotti, it's got, you know, space battles.
Spaceships, explosions.
The giant Bentley. I talk about Pete Carlos. This is just... this is extraordinary. Anyway, so I couldn't have that, and that's also feels like a little nudge in my ribs on a regular basis. But so I did have a look at a few. I mean, I've got a few. It's just the one, isn't it?
We can allow you a few, Giles.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the absence of that, I'd like the cover, the opening page to the Stainless Steel Rat Saves the World, which I think comes. I think it might be from the Eagle edition. It looks like it is to me. Yeah. It's the first page in my omnibus edition of Saves the World, which has got sort of Earth in the background and Jim and Angelina stood in front of Earth shooting guns.
Yes.
And a little historical explainer at the top there of how criminals evolved into the stainless steel rat when they were, you know, caveman bashing another caveman, a sort of highwayman and a gangster. It's really good. I really love that page.
It is an iconic page of Jim and Angelina, weapons firing and everything. I'm surprised we didn't choose it last time, but that one is available, so that becomes yours, Giles. And here it is in colour.
Yeah, it is. It's great. What is great about this is that I've never seen any of those before, I don't think. All the stuff from the Eagle versions. So that was a real treat to see, as you said, which is delightfully called the Eagle Comics 6-issue rodent series, which tickled me every time I saw it. But there was one other. I mean, again, I mean, I suppose I'm being a bit obvious by choosing covers, but they are so good. Which is the cover to Prog 400 with the kicker headline, Dogfight, the Rat Bites Back. And it's basically a wraparound spread of massive helicopter gunships shooting at each other and blowing up, just filling the entire frame. And it looks fantastic. And Carlos does these inanimate objects so well that you know what they are. So I know these are helicopters of a type, but they don't look anything really like helicopters. They look like what Carlos has imagined would a space helicopter be. Well, I'm just gonna let my imagination go wild, and he's done it. And they look exciting and otherworldly all at once, and then he makes them blow up all in the same frame. I mean, that's just glorious.
We talked about Carlos introducing us to great works of art. This is Carlos doing his Wham cover.
Yes.
I'll say Roy Lichtenstein, but I'll actually say Irv Novik from 1962, who we, you know, comic fans rightfully attribute this to. Yeah. So, yeah, that is just, I thought that one might come up because it is just such a glorious cover from Carlos, isn't it?
But also, I mean, the great thing about this is in my book, that sits right next to the Rat for President one. And the two are completely different. And yet he pulls them both off with both exceptionally. You know, the Rat for President one opens in a big crowd scene, and it has a lot of detail, a lot of small elements in it, all of which draw the eye in to them, almost like a page of panels, but all across a spread. And then you turn the page, and there's this one, and it's like bang, you know, wham, as it is in this case. Look at this, just eye popping single sort of image, absolutely fantastic. And he can veer so successfully between those two styles is extraordinary.
Yeah. Perfect stuff. Any others, Giles? Any interior pages before?
Well, I think
I pick mine.
Let me just double check here. I've got. I know it was main. Yeah, I mean, there was an early one in the first story, which again is a spread, which is a little bit similar, but which I really like. When Jim has to go to the spaceport because Angelina has been illegally building a giant battleship, and he goes to the spaceport to try and prevent her leaving. And it's a double page spread of this giant spaceship, which the builders at the spaceport think is an innocent a mining freighter, and it's taking off and firing and exploding all the ships on the ground. It's a big, again, what I like about this is Carlos is doing the spaceship. It could have been, I mean, a lot of people at this point were drawing spaceships that looked a bit like things from Star Wars. You know, you saw in the early 80s, late 70s and early 80s, you saw an awful lot of spaceships that looked like Star Destroyers or variations of various Star Wars things. Whereas Carlos just goes, well, draw what I like, thanks. And this, you know, it's clearly a spaceship. It has that, it's got an angular shape to it. But the detail on it is fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And it's doubled up with a really nice bit of exposition. Two pieces of which I adore, which is the Jim confronts the shipyard manager, who is a sort of dozy looking character, and who says, it can't be a battleship, Your Honor. Look at these plans. She's a mining freighter. We've only just finished installing the planetary excavation lasers. And Jim cries, excavation lasers? Those are gun turrets, you idiot. A great line, and then Jim escapes from the carnage that the battleship is wreaking with his little robot friend that he's got at this point, and by shouting, "Come on, Chunky, get into that flyer," which is how he refers to this enormously entertaining robot sidekick he has. Tiny, there's loads of tiny bits in that, you know, the robot sidekicks, etc. You know, there's loads of tiny little bits that crop up like that. You can blink and you miss them. But they're brilliant. He encounters a robot nurse at one point, and says, he convinces the robot nurse that he's dead because he tells the robot nurse he's dead, which the robot nurse finds hard to compute. So he just goes, "Well, look, if you can't compute it, why don't you go and bash your head against that wall over there?" And the final panel in that scene is the robot bashing its head against the wall. Beautiful stuff. So yeah, I do like that page.
Fantastic. Well, we will give you all of those pages virtually in the Mega City Book Club Art Gallery.
What are you?
They become yours. So last time I think I had the Raft of the Medusa, but this time I have chosen page 116 in the digital edition, which comes from the middle story, Stainless Hill Rat Saves the World. It is a panel showing, or rather it's a page showing Jim firing out of the page when he thinks he's killing. He's made a decision to kill because he thinks he's killing the villain. He, spoilers, he's not. But anyway, And I, again, we talk about Carlos and, you know, certain familiarity with certain panels that he was able to do. This is not an unfamiliar look for Carlos, having a character firing out, whether it be Dredd or Johnny Alpha. I'm particularly noting that his last ever Strontium Dog cover was Johnny Alpha firing off the front cover. And because I can't own that cover, because I know who does own it, and I know he's not going to ever give it up, I would like to own this page 116 from the digital of Jim firing over his blaster, thinking he's killing the villain, but unfortunately he's not. And it's also beautifully coloured by Janet Landau as well, the explosion at the bottom of the page. And as ever, I'm going to post these images in the week after this episode comes out, which in fact will be next week. So people will be able to see what we're talking about and hopefully be tempted to get their own copy of the Stainless Steel Rat colour omnibus. Yeah.
That page is really interesting. It's a lovely page, you're quite right, and the colouring is glorious. But there is what I was saying earlier, Jim is firing out of the page and shouting, "Die, you monster." He's been forced into this position. He really didn't want to have to kill him, because that's where Jim is. Jim is very moral in that respect. And I was saying about how you can see this expression in Jim's face on that, where he looks conflicted. He really does. Carlos gets that. He is not enjoying the "die you monster" moment. He's shouting "die you monster," but Carlos has managed to pull off this thing that Jim is doing something he's deeply unhappy with. Again, I mean, so that's brilliant work. Brilliant work. It's, you know, for a comic aimed at 12-year-olds, extraordinary level of achievement.
Flabbergasting how good it is. So if we've tempted you, the Stainless Steel Rat Colour Omnibus is available in hardback still for £35, paperback £25, and the digital, which I have, is £9.99, easily available from the 2080 web shop. And it is just utterly fantastic. The best James Coburn movie you'll ever read.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
It's a tribute to everybody involved, Harrison, Gosnell, Ascara, and Landau, and the letterers. It is just a fantastic piece of work.
One other thing that struck me about this when I was reading it, Eamon, if we've got time, it really struck me when I said it was a sort of object lesson. I think it is, but one of the things that I thought it did fantastically well is this appealed. I know why it appealed to me as a 13-year-old, and I can see why it appeals to 13-year-olds. And I think this is a very, very, and in that respect, it's a very clever piece of writing, a very clever adaptation, because they're grown up characters. They're adult characters. There's a lot of action. There's a lot of violence. But you are sympathetic with them, and you want them to succeed because it creates a rounded world about this. And I think this is a really interesting thing. So Jim has a moral code, and he very much sticks to it. But at the same time, he's very naughty. He's a naughty boy, and he does naughty things, and kids love that. Kids love them to misbehave. You know, you root for him. They want to root for the baddie. You know, you want Jim to succeed, even though you know, on a fundamental level, one shouldn't rob banks, but one really wants Jim to do it. And I think they absolutely nailed that with this book, and that's why it stood the test of time. And the reason that stood out to me was because I thought, With the recent regened efforts in the prog, which have of course now stopped, I actually think they could have learned more lessons from this. I think and might have been more successful in doing so, in the sense that it really, I don't know. In my opinion, this is what kids want. They want, you know, they want adult characters doing interesting and exciting things. They don't necessarily want to have to relate to a teenage character. This is, but a character like Jim, who is exciting and dangerous and a bit naughty, that's ticking all the boxes. It was ticking all the boxes for me when I'm 13. I sincerely expect it is. Whereas I was I can imagine I was left entirely cold by things like Cadet Dread and Lowborn High and things like that. I don't know why everyone felt there was a need to have teenage characters to appeal to teens. So, you know, when I was a teen, there were no teenage characters in it. The characters that appealed to me were Judge Dredd and Strontium Dog and Road Trooper, none of whom were kids. And I don't think I would have liked them if they were kids. I didn't want to read about kids. So I found this really interesting in that respect. And again, for me, in the Regine stuff that really worked was Pandora Perfect, who was a grown-up, a little bit like Slippery Jim, a lot of Slippery Jim comparisons there, and things like Department K, which were, again, just interesting characters doing stuff, but without having a token teenager there. So decades and decades apart, these things are, late 70s, early 80s, and here we are now, however many decades later. And this still stands to me, as I said at the very beginning, in an object lesson of how doing something really successfully to appeal to children. And it's not to say you're not going to love it if you're grown up, because you are going to love it if you're grown up. But I can, this is, I think, a pretty much piece of perfection in terms of writing and art for a young market.
There we are, a piece of perfection, just wonderful. Get a copy. It is fantastic. I'm now sort of tempted to actually go and get the hard copy as well as the digital, even though I can't fit any more books in the house. Right, Giles, at this point we turn to guest projects, and normally we'd be talking about Formula One, but you have, amazingly, John Cusack in High Fidelity did. You've started a record label.
Nice work. John Cusack it. I have John Cusack it in High Fidelity. Yeah, last year I started a record label. I love music. I've always loved music. It's been there throughout my life. Almost exactly as long as comics have been there, frankly. But whereas there was when everyone has a gap in the comic point at some point, when 2008 we went rubbish, but the music always stayed with me and I've always loved it. And I found myself in a position, I rediscovered my joy of going to watch live music. I went I've always enjoyed live music, but I started going back to watch very small bands in the back of pubs, and it absolutely reinvigorated me completely. I was suddenly seeing, there's a whole thriving DIY scene in this country of small bands putting on their own shows, releasing their own records, you know, managing themselves, recording themselves, doing everything. And they're playing to, you know, 50, 60, 100 people in the back of pubs all over the place. And I was seeing a lot of them, and they were all, and that so many of them were brilliant. And I really loved it. I really, really loved it, and it absolutely turned me on again to going to see live music. They do it for love as well. It isn't like turning up to a big venue, you know, a 2,500 seater venue, and they're doing it as one night of a 50 night tour, and it's just performative. They really love what they're doing, and the more I got to talking to them, and the more I talked to them, I discovered that they an awful lot of them, you know, inevitably were being completely ignored by the record industry. They just weren't interested in what they were doing, because there was no massive bottom line. The current record industry is effectively broken, in the sense that the only people who make money are people as big as Taylor Swift because of streaming. And the major record labels are basically more interested in releasing things like Led Zeppelin reissues, or artists like Taylor Swift, if they don't see a massive return, they're not even going to touch small DIY bands. So I thought, well, I don't like this very much, and I thought I'll put these records out myself. So I did, and that's what I did last year. So I set up a record label called INH Records, which stands for Insert Name Here, and that was because. While I was setting it up, I didn't have a name. And so whenever I referred to it, I would refer to it as Insert Name Here Records. And someone said, well, why don't you call it that? And I thought, well, that's a good idea. Great. So it became Insert Name Here Records. So we're on Bandcamp, INH Records on Bandcamp. And we put out our first album by the brilliant Fight Milk in November last year. So It's been a really exciting, very scary journey. I didn't know what I'm doing. I'm all right. As I said, I'm all right watching cars go around in circles and then banging away on a laptop about it. But the record industry, I knew nothing about. So it's been quite scary, bewildering, but enormously satisfying. I mean, when we put that record out and it was out there for people to buy, a record that, you know, potentially would not have been released otherwise, it gave me such a thrill. I mean, literally like nothing else. And so satisfying. Very, very time consuming, obviously. But I've done it now. It's all in operation. And in June, we're putting out a new album by a band called Coming Up Roses, who are also fantastic. And we'll have another one at the end of the year. I mean, I'm not going to bring down EMI or any of the majors at this rate, but if I'm putting out some beautiful records, then I'm going to be happy. And if your listeners want to go to INH Records at Bandcamp, give it a listen. You can buy a t-shirt or the Fight Milk album at the moment and the Coming Up Roses album in June. That would be great. I mean, you know, we all the indie bands and the indie labels need all the support we can get.
Listeners also look in the show notes for this episode or on the website. They will find a link to INH on Bandcamp and also to the piece you wrote in the Guardian about setting up your own indie label as well.
Thank you.
Amazing stuff, Giles. What a thing to do.
Very exciting.
You John Cusack did. Fantastic stuff. Look in the show notes for links to Giles' work and to the piece he wrote about his new record label, and support them, for goodness sake. Yeah, please support independent music.
Yeah.
Giles, fantastic. Thank you for coming on the book club again. Number 4, and what a brilliant volume The Stainless Steel Rat is, and what a tribute particularly to the wonderful and late lamented Carlos.
Been a pleasure to be here once again, as always, Eamon, and a pleasure to talk about this book, which, you know, I, as I've said repeatedly, can't recommend enough. Go out and get it. It's you won't regret it.
It's terrific. And thank you to everyone for listening to Megacity Book Club. As ever, find all the links, including links to Giles's record label, at megacitybookclub.com. We're on the socials, the nice ones, that is. You can email me if you've got a book or an artist or creator that you want to come on and talk about, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to revisit a classic that we've already covered, by all means, get in touch. If you've got ideas for which stories should be recolored and which ones shouldn't, and get in touch. And until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, it's a goodbye from me and
goodbye from me.